Welcome to Sports Talk Chicago's 39th podcast. My name's John Zagluel, and I'll be hosting today's show. We have so much to get to and so much to talk about today. We're looking at the Chicago Cubs and their recent trade deadline acquisitions, including Cole Hamels and Brandon Kinsler. We're also talking about the White Sox and how they've made some moves on the other end of the deadline as sellers. We'll finally get to the Bulls and Blackhawks, plus a very special guest in today's second half of the show. All of that and more, but first, just a few quick announcements. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at JohnZags, and on Twitter at JohnZSports. Today's show is brought to you by Moochie World, where inspiration meets creation. Call 708-247-2100 to book parties, paint your own pottery, and have art classes for adults and children. Moochie World, creativity at its finest. And by the Windy City Thunderbolts. Single game tickets are available now. Call 708-489-BALL. That's 708-489-2255 to purchase tickets for their next home game. Well, we're jumping right into things today as we talk about the Chicago Cubs and two big moves that they've made at this year's trade deadline. And before we analyze and talk about these moves, I have to say, great job by the Cubs in deciding to spend the money and give up low-level prospects for guys who they needed on their major league roster. I mean, I was very critical at first of the Cole Hamels trade, for example, but when I found out the Cubs gave up very little and don't have to pay for next year's salary, which is going to be nearly $25 million, I became very happy, knowing that the Cubs got a rental, didn't give up too much, and aren't on the hook for next year's salary. Anyways, let's talk about this Cole Hamels trade, because a few years ago, if you had told me that the Cubs had acquired Cole Hamels, I would have been head over heels for that idea. I mean, Hamels at one point was a bona fide NL Cy Young Award contender with the Phillies, and even in his first couple of seasons with the Rangers, had pitched very good baseball and had made an All-Star team. Unfortunately, however, the Cubs acquired the 34-year-old Cole Hamels, a guy who's 5-9 on the season with an ERA just under 5.0. And I have to digress for a minute, because at one point, Cole Hamels was on his way to a Hall of Fame career. I mean, going into the 2017 season, Hamels had 136 wins and already eclipsed 2,000 strikeouts. This was heading into his age 33 season, mind you. He was on pace to get to 3,000 strikeouts, number one, 200 wins, number two, and a possible Hall of Fame case come the end of his career. But these past two seasons have derailed his cause. He's gone a combined 16-15 with an ERA just north of 4.40 combined. That is horrible, that is non-Hall of Fame worthy, and that is non-Cole Hamels. Hamels is mostly known for his ability to win games and pitch to an ERA south of 3.30 on average. But these past 2 years have been hectic and have been horrible for Hamels. So when I found out that the Cubs traded for him, I was at first appalled, as I mentioned before, because Hamels had not been doing well, and I was worried that the Cubs gave up too much to get him. But when I found out that they gave up two lower-level prospects, and again, were not responsible for his salary come next season, I was more happy and more open to the idea. Remember that Hamels actually pitches very well at Wrigley Field and threw his only no-hitter against the Cubs in 2015. And if the Cubs were lucky enough to get the Hamels of old, a guy who would pitch to an ERA under 3 while winning 10 to 14 games plus contending for a Cy Young Award, that would be an added bonus and a much-needed piece to their rotation. But what made the move even sweeter to me is not even the fact that the Cubs got Cole Hamels. It was the fact that Tyler Chatwood was demoted finally to the bullpen. Chad Wood this season has been atrocious and a huge waste of money. He's making $13 million to lead all of baseball in walks by a wide margin. He's not worth the money, and he's not worth the Cubs' time at this point. The Cubs are contending for an NL pennant once again and possible World Series appearance. They don't need a guy like Tyler Chatwood getting in the way and causing things to go awry. And as for Chatwood's fate in the bullpen, Joe Maddon has said that he doesn't know what to do. We don't even know if Chatwood is going to pitch in low-leverage situations, let alone situations that matter. So Chatwood's whole problem is put on the back burner right now because the Cubs have work to do. And Cole Hamels, who has won a World Series himself with Philadelphia, is here to help. In other Cubs trade deadline news, the team has picked up Brandon Kinsler from the Washington Nationals in exchange for minor leaguer Joan Romero, who was at Class Single-A Advanced Myrtle Beach. Now, Kinsler's another interesting player because last year he was also dealt at the deadline after making the All-Star team last season. Now, Kinsler this season has done okay. He hasn't been overly spectacular, but does have a 3.59 ERA and an ERA plus of 119, meaning that he's better than 19% of his relieving peers. But if the Cubs get Kinsler from last season, with an ERA plus of 147, a shutdown closer with the Twins, and a shutdown reliever with the Nationals, then this move is quite important and noteworthy. Because going into the deadline, the Cubs knew they needed a shutdown reliever. They didn't have anybody. Despite Steve Cishek and Pedro Strop carrying the load, they had Morrow on the DL, Brian Dunsing pitching to an ERA above 7, and Justin Wilson performing inconsistently. The Cubs needed a consistent shutdown arm at the back of their bullpen, and that's what they're hoping to get with Brandon Kinsler. And by the way, as I mentioned before, Kinsler was a former closer. He could probably step in and fill the shoes of Brandon Morrow until he gets back. So this Kinsler move serves multiple purposes, both of which will help the Cubs and not hurt them. To conclude, though, I'm very happy with both of these acquisitions by the Cubs because I feel that both of these players in Kinsler and Hamels can provide reliable and steady production. If Hamels and Kinsler could live up to their expectations, I have no doubt that they'll help lead the Cubs to the promised land once again. Going to the south side, we now talk about some Chicago White Sox news. And as we know, due to the fact that the White Sox are out of contention and are trying to rebuild, the Sox are sellers at this year's trade deadline. Although the Sox don't have much to offer, they did pull off a trade involving Joaquin Soria going to the Milwaukee Brewers. And I give the Sox lots of credit because Soria this year has had a resurgent campaign on the mound. He's pitched to a 2.43 ERA and recorded 16 saves with the team. He also has an ERA plus at 173. He's actually one of the best relievers in the game, according to that stat. And they unloaded him on the Brewers for two prospects. Not bad for a guy the White Sox received in a trade back on January 4th. And for the White Sox, it's a shame, because the Sox had multiple players that they could have dealt but have had bad years and injury-plagued years, which has thrown a wrench in the process. I mean, Jose Abreu made the All-Star team, and right around that time, there was so much talk surrounding his name, but since then, he's now hitting .258 on the year, and his OPS is .774. This is his worst year in his entire career in the major leagues. Now, nobody wants him, and no one's willing to give up prospects to get him. The same goes for Avi Garcia. Garcia last season contended for the AL batting title and did so well. But this year, he's been limited to 44 games, and in that time has hit .277 with a .293 on base percentage. So, he's been hurt, and when he's been on the field, he hasn't done well. Who in their right mind would want to trade for him? And on the mound, you've got guys like James Shields and even Hector Santiago, who could have gotten traded. But both of those guys are not doing well, and especially for Shields, who's entering his age 37 season come next year, he is not a hot commodity. He needed to do somewhat well in order to get traded, and pitching to a 4.53 ERA despite 137 innings isn't going to cut it. And in Santiago's case, this was a guy who the White Sox signed to a one-year deal back in the offseason, but he has not performed, pitching to an ERA over 5. The White Sox had multiple opportunities to trade players, but because of their poor performances on the field, they received little to no interest. Luckily enough, Joaquin Soria panned out, and the Sox got something in return. Sox fans, I know it must be difficult right now. You're watching your team trying to sell and get pieces for the future. But let me tell you this. When the Cubs got rid of Jeff Samardzija at the time, they got back Addison Russell from the A's. And although I think that he hasn't lived up to his expectations, he's still the team's starting shortstop and helped lead them to the 2016 World Series. Your time will come, and this trade deadline, selling assets, is the best thing that the White Sox could be doing. Moving on to the Chicago Bulls, and the team has re-signed Ryan Arcidiacono to a partially guaranteed deal. Last year, Arcidiacono was under a two-way contract, meaning that he started the year in the G League and later found some minimal playing time on the Bulls. This year in the Summer League, though, he didn't have the year that he wanted, posting 7.2 points per game on 39% shooting from the field. It sounds okay, but when you figure that he played 31 minutes per contest, those numbers are horrible, atrocious even. Now, what makes this deal a good thing is that Arcidiacono is not a part of the Bulls' immediate plans or immediate future. He's not a guy the Bulls are relying on. He's simply some bench piece, and maybe he'll get some time at the NBA level. So this isn't a bad signing necessarily, but Arcidiacono himself needs to improve his game if he wants any chance of playing at the NBA level this season. In other Bulls news, there was a recent Q&A released by Casey Johnson of the Chicago Tribune, and the first question that popped up had to do with Jabari Parker making $20 million per year. Now, if you remember on my last podcast, I had bashed this signing, claiming that Parker is not even close to being worth $20 million, and I maintain that belief today. But here's what Johnson had to say about why the Bulls decided to offer $20 million. Quote, that proved the cost to structure the contract the way the Bulls and Parker's representatives did. Owning a team option rather than a non-guaranteed second season is beneficial both to the Bulls and Parker, particularly if he plays well and they want to negotiate a long-term deal. Plus, the Bulls, knowing they want to get minutes for reserves Denzel Valentine and Chandler Hutchison, had made the decision to move on from David Nwaba, so they weren't targeting their cap space for anything else. I understand what Johnson is saying. I mean, the Bulls have cap space. Why not use it on someone they're trying to get? The point is, though, Jabari Parker is not worth $20 million. I mean, this is a guy who's coming off an ACL tear, and a guy who, when he came back last year, didn't produce, plain and simple. I mean, he averaged 12.6 points in 24 minutes played in 31 games. That is horrible in comparison to the year before when he was healthy, averaging 20.1. But even if you want to look at those past stats, the point is Jabari Parker has not proved himself in the NBA yet. Heck, he hasn't even made an All-Star team. So I don't understand where this $20 million number comes from. I mean, if anything, this was a hometown pick, as we mentioned in our last show. He's from the Chicago area. He played basketball at Simeon, and everyone was happy and up in arms to welcome him here to Chicago. That doesn't mean, however, that he's a good basketball player. Yet for some reason, everyone continues to mix those two ideas up, and now the Bulls have spent $20 million on an injury-prone player who probably won't produce for this team. And before we get to today's special guest, it's time for some Chicago Blackhawks news and some big headlines coming from the Daily Herald and John Deets involving Corey Crawford, the Blackhawks goalie who was hurt most of last season. Now Deets, who reported on this story, talked to Kevin Weeks. He's an NHL Network analyst and former goalie. Now Weeks said that Crawford is the most important player on the Blackhawks, even with respect to Patrick Kane. But when Weeks was asked about Corey Crawford and if he'll be the same player that he once was, he said, quote, "I mean, he's got a long road ahead of him. You know and I know, the NHL talent doesn't wait on anybody." Well, to say the least, those aren't encouraging words. I mean, Weeks contends that Crawford is the Hawks' best player and most important player, yet at the same time, he thinks that he will regress and get worse coming off of this injury. And as for the Hawks' goalie situation right now, all they have to back up Crawford is Cam Ward and Anton Forsberg. That doesn't sound too good, having those two guys backing up a very important player on this Hawks team. Look, I'm a firm believer in the fact that last season didn't go well for the Hawks because they didn't have their goalie situation attended to. This year, it could be the same old song and dance for the Hawks as they do not have a viable backup plan for Corey Crawford. And because of that, it may be a very long season for Hawks fans once again. And with that, it's time for our special guest. He began his broadcasting career in 1982 as the TV and radio voice of the Kansas City Kings. By 1998, he had called national basketball and football games for NBC, ESPN, Fox Sports, Turner Sports, and CBS. Today, he broadcasts NFL games on CBS and Westwood One, as well as NBA games on TNT. He's also the reigning National Broadcaster of the Year, presented by NSMA. Please welcome the great Kevin Harlan to the show. Kevin, how are you doing today, and thank you for being here on the show.
John, great to be on again and visit with you. Thank you so much for having me.
To start today, Kevin, I wanted to talk about the NBA and how many players, once again, including big names like LeBron James and DeMarcus Cousins, are on the move here in the offseason. Speaking of LeBron, what are your thoughts on his move to L.A., and did you see this coming?
Well, I think LeBron is at the stage of his career where he's looking at a couple things. First of all, he's got a family that's growing, and he's got a son who's a year out of being in school, and I know he's concerned about where the kids are going to grow up, what schools are going to go to, and now, and the kids are getting older, so he's got to, I know, make that his major concerns. They already had a home in California, so some people guess that maybe he would finish out his career there and raise his family there. And nothing against his hometown of Akron or the Cleveland area, but I think he just felt that personally for him, in the kind of things that he wanted to do in his post-career, production, movies, films, documentaries, whatever it might be, it'd be a lot easier to establish himself out there at the tail end of his career and get a chance to begin, kind of get a head start in that portion while he finished out his last 4, 5, 6 years playing NBA basketball, not unlike Kobe Bryant. And I think he also said the other day that he had always dreamt of playmakers, always been on his radar and air it to do it. He must like something about the team, too. He knows that as he goes down in history, the number of championships he wins will be compared with Kobe and certainly with Michael Jordan and the other greats who have played the game. And he's been in the finals many times, but he still lacks some championships to equal Kobe up with Michael. So I think there was just a lot for him to consider. He thought at this stage of his life, this stage of his career, that the Lakers were the best move. When you start to consider all those factors, I guess it makes sense.
Now, some have said that the Lakers have gone after other players, you know, to build a supporting cast around LeBron, and some have claimed that that supporting cast will not support a championship. do you see LeBron winning it all at some point during his time with the Lakers?
Well, not as they're constituted right now. There's no chance. I mean, he's not, the group around him isn't really much better than what he had in Cleveland. You need, I think it shows in the current NBA, at least two superstars and preferably three, as we've seen with Golden State. That's what Houston's trying to do right now, is they reel in Carmelo, and they got Chris Paul last year, and they've got Harden. And, you know, I just think teams feel they need multiples. In Boston, they've got an all-star in Hayward. They've got an all-star in Kyrie Irving. They've got an all-star in Al Horford. And I think that has been pretty much the consensus. You need, you know, traditionally at least two and preferably three superstars. And they may have a budding one in Ingram. They may have other guys considering Los Angeles, but right now it's LeBron, and it's going to be at least a couple years before they're able to, you know, lasso another guy that is even in that same paragraph with LeBron James. That's going to be tough to do, but he's hoping they're going to do it. And there was some thought, of course, that Paul George may go out there, and that didn't happen, or that Kawhi Leonard may sign out there in a trade with San Antonio. That didn't happen, as he goes to Toronto. So right now it's LeBron James and a very unproven roster that was below 500 a year ago. And it would not seem, at least, especially in the West, where he's going to have another chance at the finals for the next couple years. And I'm sure that's the one real challenge in this whole scenario for LeBron, is that it may fit his family, may fit his post-career, but right now it doesn't fit his current playing status to be on a championship team as the Lakers constituted and put together right now.
You know, I wanted to go to all of these moves going on in the NBA. Now, some have called for the NBA to step in and kind of facilitate where players decide to go, rather. Do you see this as a viable option, or should the league let things work themselves out?
Well, I think that capitalism is one of the foundations that this country has been built on. It has been something that leagues have tried to, you know, make a part of their normal operating procedure. That's why you've got a salary cap, so that all teams have kind of an equal chance with money to lure players. Some clear space differently than other teams. And we've seen some teams completely play young players in the hope that they'll get a high drafting position, some that have cleared a roster so they have a lot of money to spend to sign to LeBron James or whoever. So, you know, there are different ways for management to build, and that's kind of what capitalism is all about. There are different ways to build a company, build wealth, your brand, so to speak, and these teams have chosen certain ways to do it. I don't know that interference from government, or interference in this case from a commissioner's position or the league office, really would do the kind of justice to making the best teams thrive, and the teams that lack in talent in the free and the free market area and the front office, you know, can sit there and learn from mistakes and hopefully change the direction there. It's all about competition. Some teams make the right decisions and some teams don't. And I don't know if the league needs to step in, but it has been done in the past and was met with, you know, a lot of negativity from the people that observed the league. Most recently, when David Stern, who was at that time helping control a New Orleans franchise that was in kind of an in-between place, nicks a Chris Paul trade to the Lakers. And because of that, you know, there's been this far-reaching opinion by many that did nothing but hurt the league. You need to leave the free enterprise system out there. And some teams just operate more adroitly and more and smartly than others. And the success and the talent of that stands out, forcing owners to hire a better front office and be more clever, know the ins and outs of the bargaining agreement, a strategy and implement it. And that's the competition that happens outside and off the court and in the office, and some stand out and some don't.
We have Kevin Harlan here on Sports Talk Chicago. And Kevin, moving to the NFL, we've also seen teams like the Browns and Packers improve their stock through the draft and free agency. which teams are ready to surprise the league here in 2018?
Well, everybody right now, all the teams are boasting that they've made the right offseason moves to become viable and challenge the champion Philadelphia Eagles. There are the mainstays, and that would be Pittsburgh, certainly, and New England, and in the NFC, it looks like Green Bay with Rodgers back is going to be one of those teams. The Rams, with their turnaround, seem to have bolstered their defense. There are a lot of teams that right now, you know, feel like they can do damage. The Vikings seem to be a favorite of so many now that they've got some stability at quarterback, and you can certainly see that. So there are teams all over the NFL that have the wherewithal. Atlanta certainly in the Super Bowl a couple years ago. I don't know if there's going to be a surprise. There always is. It's hard to kind of pluck right now. A lot of people in the AFC have talked about the Chargers because they began so horribly last year, turned their season around, finished 9-3, and have bolstered their defense with some healthy players coming back, a veteran quarterback. Maybe some additions on offense. They lost their tight end. They were hoping to take Gates' play. But, you know, right now they're just, it's fun to read all the optimism from all 32 teams. And I think it's incredibly difficult to sit here and say this team or that team. I mean, who could have figured that Jacksonville would do what they did a year ago? But they did. And they feel very bullish on 2018. So, let's get into week 6 or 7. To get a feel for what teams are doing, and at that time you can kind of see a settled roster, a pattern of play by all these teams, and a much better indicator than what we've got right now, because there are going to be substantial injuries. We've already seen 7 or 8 blown knees by starting players around the league. Verrett in Los Angeles with the Chargers, Jake Ryan, a linebacker, started for Green Bay, and the names go on and on. So we need to see how camp finishes. Let's get a month into the season, 6 weeks into the season. I think then we can pretty much tell, at least with more purpose, who the teams are going to be to watch as we conclude the season.
You know, the NFL, though, has made some headlines about their policy regarding the national anthem protest. And even Jerry Jones, the Cowboys owner, has stated that his players must stand for the national anthem. How do you think the league will proceed, especially after all of the backlash surrounding this sensitive topic?
Well, I don't know, and it's still a kind of a very fluid story and kind of a work in progress. And, one of the positive signs that the league and the Players Association have been in a lot of meetings to try to come up with some, you know, unified role in this ongoing story. What that's going to be, I don't think anyone really has a great indication, but it is a part of every story that you read with these teams and with the NFL. And, it seems to be something or other every beginning of the season. When you're the biggest, most powerful, most expensive, most successful league, you know, people are going to scrutinize it more. And they have looked at concussions, and they have looked at rules changes, and they have looked at domestic violence, and now it is the anthem, in addition to all those other stories. And that's going to be a story that will develop, I'm sure, these next, you know, 3-4 weeks as we head into the regular season. I think everyone's pretty anxious to see what kind of common ground the two sides can find to, you know, make sure that every area that needs to be shown sensitivity is shown that sensitivity.
I wanted to shift to your personal career, and in January, you were named the National Sportscaster of the Year by the National Sports Media Hall of Fame. What's the story behind you winning this honor, and how much does it mean to you?
Well, it means a great deal because, unlike other awards, this is a award that is voted on by your peers. It's voted on by the people that do exactly what you do. And that's usually where the most knowledgeable minds will converge to make that election. So obviously, with that as a backdrop, you're incredibly humbled and pretty much stunned that they would think of your work in that regard. And there are so many great broadcasters. I wouldn't for a minute think that because I've received this, that my work is superior to anybody else's. I have such respect, and there are so many great broadcasters going right now that I would never for a minute even possibly think that my work is superior to others. But what it does, quite honestly, is it gives you, at least personally, a feel that, okay, you know, at least I'm on the right path. No one's ever had a perfect broadcast. We're all trying to evolve and improve all the time. But what you've done to this point has been noticed by others. And that makes it incredibly gratifying. So the fact that it's not voted on by a committee of 10 who may not even do what you do, is voted on by the people that do exactly what you do, and hundreds of them vote on it, incredibly gratifying, and something that I hold very dear and am very, very proud of.
You know, speaking of your broadcasting career, I know you've done Monday Night Football on Westwood One for a number of years, but this year you'll be without your longtime partner, Boomer Esiason. How difficult will this be for you?
Well, John, it's going to be very difficult. They have not yet named a successor. There are a lot of prominent, well-known names in the running for it, and it's a highly coveted position. I think most people, maybe they wouldn't be surprised at how many people have inquired about it that work Sundays and would like to do Mondays as well. It's an honor because the league is, to a degree involved in the selection because this is part of their partnership with not only the major TV networks, but with Westwood One, their dominant national radio carrier. It's a decision which is highly thought of and scrutinized, but Boomer was so terrific on a variety of levels. He's always been a friend, but our friendship grew even more because the 9-10 years we were together on Monday Night Football. He always treated me, although he has been honored in so many national ways as MVP, Pro Bowl quarterback, played in Super Bowls. He's been a part of 19 Super Bowl broadcasts in some fashion or form on TV, on radio, and now is an analyst with CBS on their pregame show, and they'll do the Super Bowl this year in Atlanta. So he's done more than any other broadcaster has ever done, and that makes him historic in that regard. He's one of the biggest voices commenting on pro football today, the number one sport in this country. So for him to always treat me as an equal and more importantly for me as a friend, every time we put on the headset, stepped into that Monday night booth, was something I really cherished and treasure the memory of and will miss that dearly. I've also worked with a variety of other people on Monday nights, whether it be James Lofton or Kurt Warner or others, and have always embraced those friendships and that association as well. So I know that Westwood will make, in conjunction with the NFL, a very great choice, and whoever it is, I'm anxious to work with them and begin another chapter of that Monday night broadcasting career. But there's no doubt that the broadcast will be different without the longtime voice of it in Boomer Esiason. He was terrific in every way.
Is there someone specific that you had in mind about joining you on this broadcast?
Well, I've always trusted the process of the people that employ me. So while my name has never been asked, the people that I've worked with, whether it be at CBS or at Westwood, I've always embraced. So I know that a lot of times in this business, what happens is something that's out of your control. And so because of that process, I've always just trusted the process. So whoever they put in there next to me, I'll be thrilled about. The names that are being bandied about are well known, like I said, in the business. There are three or four names that have kind of been circled, and any of those three or four would be terrific and would have big shoes to fill, quite honestly, with what Boomer has established in that position over the many decades.
You know, with you being such a prominent voice here in sports today, I wanted to know, what's the greatest sports moment that you've been able to call?
Well, John, I don't know that I've had it. I mean, I've had some great ones. Certainly Super Bowl endings are big, and the Malcolm Butler interception for the Patriots, the goal line of Russell Wilson, the comeback by the New England Patriots in that, in another Super Bowl. I've done some very memorable NCAA tournament games, which have been memorable, and NBA playoff games, which stand out. But I guess I feel like maybe my best moment is yet to come, or my most memorable moment, I should say, is yet to come. And that's what you prepare for. I think as a broadcaster, you never feel like, okay, I've got this. I'm set. I've put my period on my career. I can coast from here. That's not the case at all. Even though I started broadcasting when I was 14, you know, my 34th consecutive year of the NFL and 33rd year doing NBA basketball, feel like maybe my most memorable moment is yet to come, and I want to make sure that I'm ready for it. So continue to evolve and work harder now than I have, want to be more prepared. Attention to detail always becomes the first thing I put in my mind before I begin every broadcast and every prep week of broadcasting. And I just know it's never been more scrutinized a position than it is now with social media. Well, I want to make sure that I can say to myself and look at myself in the mirror that I've done everything I feel I can do. And if it's not a mistake, then it gives me something to work on for the next broadcast. But it's always changing. And I think Marv Albert probably feels that as much as I do in my 50s as I am now, and as much as any young broadcaster may feel that maybe in their 20s or 30s, you know, getting started in the business. You constantly evolve, and that's the one thing that I kind of embrace, and I love that challenge. That challenge is something that kind of, I think, motivates me all the time, and I'm sure it motivates a lot of broadcasters the same way, regardless of age.
And on a final note, going back to 2015 during a Bulls and Lakers game, you were sitting courtside calling the action for TNT when, all of a sudden, the ball had gotten knocked away, and it somehow found you on the sideline. What was really funny about this moment is that you ended up calling the play-by-play action of the ball flying into your face. Take me through what happened there.
Well, you know, we're courtside, luckily, and fortunately, and so that gives us a very good view, but, you know, we can literally lean over and grab a jersey if we had, because we're so close to the action, as is any patron and ticket holder that may have a seat courtside. And the ball flew in and kind of caught me in the headset and the head. Normally, you know, when you're hit by a ball or a flying player diving for a ball, you know, the security or the guys that are manning the areas for the court will rush over to make sure you're okay. And a drink has been spilled or food has been spilled, and they'll make sure that everything is all right. And sure enough, we had guys approaching us, and I wanted to make sure that they knew that I was fine. And so kind of jokingly, and I wasn't really even hit in the head, but jokingly said, I'm fine. I'm okay. Don't worry about me. I'm good. And something that probably the average fan would say if they were on, you know, in the same position on the court at the same time and something like that would happen to them. So it was more in fun than anything else. And you kind of got to guard yourself sometimes from getting too comfortable on these national broadcasts because, you know, really you forget sometimes how many millions that you're speaking to and broadcasting to. And you sometimes have got to catch yourself and say, wait a minute, you know, you've got to have a little decor. So I always look back on those moments and go, I don't know if I should have done that. But if you're not doing it all the time and showing the fans at home that you're just like them, you're having fun, maybe there's some value in that.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for being here on the show. As always, it was a pleasure to have you on today.
John, always great following your career. I know we've got conversations ahead of us, and I'll look forward to those in the future. But congratulations on your great start, and I really appreciate the chance to visit with you today. Thank you so much.
Well, there you have it. My interview with Kevin Harlan was, as always, quite enjoyable and informative, and I talked to him after the show, and he is just one of the classiest individuals in the broadcasting business. He subscribes to the website. He's one of my most famous subscribers, and it was such an honor and privilege to have him on again here today. Before we finish up today, it's time for the Announcer's Call of the Day segment. And if you missed the interview with Kevin Harlan, I encourage you to go back to our last question, where I talked to him about a ball hitting him in the face during a broadcast in 2015. He expressed laughter while reflecting on it, and I was able to find Kevin's call of what happened.
Kevin Harlan just took one right in the grill.
I'm all right.
Right to you, Kevin.
I'm okay.
Harlan.
Don't worry about me. Taking one for the team here. I'm protecting you. Oh, my gosh. Look at the pain. Watch it again. Taking one for the team. Blocking out. That right. Oh, look at this. Look at that. I know. Get away. I'm fine.
What a funny moment there with Kevin Harlan. And as he described in his answer, he didn't want any special treatment. He knew he was okay, which is why he kept saying, get away, I'm fine. But still, a very funny moment from a great broadcaster in Kevin Harlan. Well, that does it for us here at Sports Talk Chicago. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at ChiTalkSports and hit me up personally on Google+, LinkedIn, and Instagram at John Zags, and on Twitter at John Z Sports. Also, Sports Talk Chicago is now on Google Play and iTunes. Simply search Sports Talk Chicago in the search bar, and you'll be directed to our podcasts. Every podcast from the 2018 calendar year is now available on iTunes and Google Play. And finally, make sure to subscribe to the website. You can find the subscription box on the homepage of the site. Type in your email, then confirm in your inbox. And once you do that, you'll receive every new podcast and article directly to your email. Thank you again for listening to today's show, and have a great day.